You're listening to the Own the Build podcast, where each week, Paul Hemming from Sealink interviews experts on how SME developers and contractors can transform their business through intelligent construction management.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 44 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming, and Liam Curley. How are you today, Liam?
I'm good, thanks, Paul. Sun's shining. It's nothing. What more can I say?
Well, I mean, generally when there's a bit of chit-chat going on, there's a little bit more that you could say. How are you feeling deep inside of you, Liam?
Well, I'm going to bat it back to you again. You've got the pressure on. How are you today, Paul?
I'm excellent. I am thoroughly, thoroughly excellent. Do you want to know why I'm good, Liam?
Yeah, go on.
Because today we are going to talk about construction contracts, and you know I love them, so I'm a happy man. I'm not sure you're quite as happy as I am, but I'm happy.
No, I'm going to be really happy with this because, well, I don't want to spoil the intro, but I'm going to be happy with this one.
You're interested, are you? You're engaged.
Well, I'm going to be in sync, I think, judging by the name of this podcast.
Well, without further ado then, I'll introduce today's episode and our guest. So the episode is titled, Can Construction Contracts Be 500 Words Long? Mind already blown. We're joined by Sarah Fox, who is a construction contract expert and is director and founder of 500 Words Limited, who are a company delivering simple digital contracts to put construction companies in control. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Hello, Sarah.
Very good to have you on. Now, the running joke on this show is I'm a boring QS and Liam is an interesting marketing guy. So you see, this is what...
No one ever suggested the second bit. But
it's been in the background. It's been in the background. So I've been taking a lot of flat. Liam's a cool guy. But today, I feel like I've got the centre of the ground here. I'm happy with construction contracts. So, Sarah, it's amazing to have you here. I'm really fascinated by your career and how you've set up your business. Can you just describe a little bit about yourself, your journey in the industry and what you now do?
Well, I suppose I have a probably more boring background than either of you two because I'm both a lawyer and I'm a maths graduate. So, you know,
it doesn't
get more boring in terms of what people expect from meeting me. I was a construction solicitor in a top five global law firm for 15 years. I'm a dual qualified lawyer and trainer, and I think it was during training people on construction contracts that I realised how few of them understood anything I was talking about. And they'd come on training courses about one of the standard forms, and I'd ask them basic questions about what was in there, and then I'd ask them whether they'd read it, and most of them kind of looked at their feet, shuffled around a bit and kind of said, well, all of it?
No one's read all of the JCC.
Nobody's read all of it, yeah. And then I'd ask them questions that I thought were fairly, you know, core to understanding a construction project and a construction contract. And it rapidly became apparent that most of them could not answer those questions. And I thought, well, what's the point? What's the point of all this paper? What's the point of all this arguing, all this negotiating about dotting the I's and crossing the T's and all that kind of stuff when everyone just shoves them in a drawer? And that's kind of the running joke in construction, that a good contract is one you shove in the drawer. And that's just so far from being true. A good contract is one that you can pin on a notice board and follow. That's it. That's what it should be doing. It should be helping run the project, not run disputes. So I kind of developed a 500-word contract. It came out of a coffee conversation with my sister, waiting for a train at Euston, and bad coffee drives good innovation, I have to say. I was just kind of thinking about how I could develop a tool for training courses that would allow people to kind of think about what should be in a contract. And she just said, well, can you write one in 500 words? I was like, yeah, of course I can. And then I had to then go and do it, because obviously I didn't set up my business until I worked out I could do it in 500 words. That was the tricky bit. But I thought that's a real challenge, because I knew that existing contracts were sometimes sort of 50,000 words and more than that. Like 50,000 words is the kind of length of a short Harry Potter novel, one of the first ones before J.K. Rowling got really into her stride. But you know what? Nobody would give someone else a novel and say, oh, by the way, you're, you know, Hermione or Snape or whatever. Just go and read that and tell me what you're going to do on this project. That would be bonkers. So, you know, the idea that we've got these really long, boring novels, which nobody reads, everyone shoves in a drawer and goes, yeah, that was a really good use of time. Because the thing is, unlike a J.K. Rowling novel, they're not £9. And you can't get them from charity shops. They cost thousands of pounds in time and effort and energy. And then we just shove them in a drawer. So what was the point? I just kind of, that kind of frustration has taken me down a massive rabbit hole.
Well, it's really interesting. And I'm going back to what you said about a good contract is one that you shove in the drawer and you don't look at for the entirety of the job. Now, I worked predominantly on JCT contracts, which were then amended. So you had the JCT plus then, I don't know, 50,000 words of amendments. But you'd be there negotiating pre-contract this document, and they'd be saying, or the client, they, as I've put them, but it always, there's so much friction in these conversations. They're saying, the thing is, we won't even need this. I was like, well, then why are we even talking about it? It just doesn't make any sense. But that's symptomatic of the whole approach, isn't it? That's just where we are as an industry. So, out of interest, and if we can talk about the JCT, because that's one of the few ones that I know in more depth as a suite, how many words does the JCT design and build contract have in it?
So JCT design and build has about 50,000 words. The average schedule of amendments has another 50,000 words. And that's only the conditions. I'm not talking about the annexes. I'm not talking about the documents that are attended, you know, appended to the back. And none of the works documents. This is just the core legal conditions. Well, I don't know about you, but 100,000 words doesn't seem like a sensible use of anyone's time, effort or money. So it doesn't really help the process. There's some really interesting data from World Commerce and Contracting, who are sort of a contract and commercial management organisation. And they reckon that less than 0.07% of contracts end up in serious dispute. That is a tiny amount that end up in serious dispute. You know, that's not even legal proceedings, smaller proportion again. And we're putting all our effort into creating something which is designed for legal enforcement rather than for running a project. You know, it's never going to run a project if we can't stick it on a fridge or a notice board.
Definitely not. But so if we're comparing your 500 word contract with a 50,000 JCT, that's 1% of the content effectively, which is mesmerizing. I would love to have 99% less to work with, but I'm fascinated, and I haven't seen your 500 word contract. How does it look? How is it framed, and what is in it?
So I've worked with an information designer because I didn't want it to look like a contract. I wanted it to get away from the dry and dusty small print, tiny, you know, lots and lots of numbers, all that kind of stuff. I didn't want it to be off-putting. I wanted it to be visually appealing, colorful, and to make sense. So essentially it's two sides of A4 done in color-coded sections, so you know that if you're the contractor, you follow the purple side, and if you're the client, you follow the green, so that you've got it follows in chronological order. So what you need to do before you start the project, during the project, if the project changes or goes wrong, or you need to end the contract. So it's designed to be really simple. It's designed to be something you could open out, stick on a notice board, and everyone would know what they're doing. And the thing is, in construction, so much of what we do is actually by common practice, not by reference to the contract anyway. We kind of know that when we get to a certain stage, then we'll put an application for payment in, it'll get jiggled around, then it get paid. Lots of the stuff that's done isn't done because the contract says we do it. It's because we've always done it that way. Yeah. So having a contract which then disagrees with what we do in practice is pointless, because it's not changing or driving behaviour, and it doesn't reflect what's actually happening on the ground. It means that when the lawyers get hold of it, they've just got a field day because nobody's been following what it says anyway. So I wanted to kind of think about what's the really important stuff to write down that will be different on this project from other projects, not what's in common with everything we've ever done before, because, well, that's just teaching people to suck eggs. What's the point of that? You know, nobody needs to be patronised on a document.
Yeah, so your 500 words is a bespoke per project, or it's a template?
So it's kind of like the framework. It's like a template or framework. By the time you've filled in information about the works, the program, the payments, it's not going to be 500 words because description of the works on an average project is several thousand words. So you can't do that. But you're looking at describing who the parties are, what the works are, the cost you're going to pay, when you're going to complete it, the objectives of the parties. And one of the first bits of feedback I had was because my contract starts with the client's key objective is time, cost or quality, tick one. Everyone said, oh, you can't do that. It's like, but you have to decide which is the most important, because then when changes happen, you know what you're going to focus on. Is it getting it done quicker or cheaper or to the right quality? Because if you don't know that focus, you end up going round and round in circles. So that actually trying to get the client to even think about which is the most important thing to them on a project was kind of so innovative. People said, oh, no, you know, we can't do that.
Yeah,
we can't
do that. Imagine.
It's like, I'm only on line two of the contract. You already arguing.
It's making me nervous. It's making me nervous thinking about it. But so what then, let's take that as an example. So how have people reacted to that? How has that actually practically played out on projects?
Well, you know, some people will just, they will refuse to use it. And I don't get to see how people use the contract. And a lot of the purpose of the contract was really to kind of not say this is the perfect way of doing it, this is the answer to our current contracts. It's to say, do you know what? We've always done it like this, but this is a radically different solution. Could we move a little bit more towards a radically different 500 words approach rather than, you know, sticking with what we know?
50,000, then let's amend the 50,000 and let's get further and further away from it. That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah.
If we start with 500, we'll get to a couple of thousand maybe. But if we start with 50,000, we're not going to get less than 50,000 at the end. So, you know what? It was really a big kick up the backside to the industry to say, look, I know we've been doing it like this way for so long, but actually, if we take a blank piece of paper and focus on the 10 things that I think are really essential to write clearly, then we've got a better framework, a better template onto which you can add your other things. And don't get me wrong, most clients do add their other stuff to it, and quite a lot of them will take things out. But it was really also to show that, you know, there are various things we kind of take for granted as not being said, like it starts with the parties shall cooperate or will cooperate on a project. And then people go, oh, I don't know about that. It's like, well, you have to.
That in itself, that sentence or that emotion tells you everything that we've got wrong. You think, well, I don't want to cooperate. Well, what's the point of what?
But you have
to get into contract. Yeah.
Not only practically, but the law says you have to.
Yeah.
So, you know, implied in every contract is the idea that this is a construction project. You can't have the client just fly to the moon, sit there for 6 months, come back and hope that everything's been done in their absence exactly as they wanted. That's not going to happen. So we need that sort of understanding that this is a joint project rather than it's the client's project or the contractor's project. You know, we have to draw people in to thinking
it's
about
a collaboration
these
we're working together.
Yeah.
Liam, tell me what you're thinking. I can see the cogs are turning. It was pretty much when colour coding came into it, I saw your eyes spark alight.
Thank you. So the first question I was going to ask was, who's predominantly using your contract? So if it's for example, a main contractor, subcontractor relationship, which of those parties are predominantly taking your contract?
Yeah, predominantly the people who use my contracts are the people who don't have in-house legal expertise. So main contractors tend to have internal legals. And even if individuals within that business like the idea of it, their in-house legals are just risk averse. They've been trained to be risk averse. That's what lawyers are trained to be. They're like, no, we can't possibly do that. So a lot of the people, but because I've written books, I don't know who uses it. You know, it could be, you know, anyone. And some of them are using it to kind of think about how they could do things differently on their bigger contracts and make them smaller. Some of them are using them as a template. Some of them are just learning what could go in and then using it as a building block approach. So it's really difficult. It's like saying to the people who make Lego, well, who uses Lego and what do they build with it? Well, until people start Instagramming contracts, and I, you know, that's a step too far for most people, I'm not going to know. You know, contracts are not pretty. They're not shareable in that kind of way. And people take it quite personally, what they've done. So I don't get a lot of feedback about who's using it until people go, you know what, I've written one of your contracts for my business. It really helps me. You know, I can't believe I haven't done this before. And for the first time, I understand what I'm doing.
Because I think back to, I was subcontracting for a time, but I'd come into subcontracting from a different environment, from design agency, things like that. So the way I worked it initially was how I had done so outside the industry, which was basically I put a proposal together, had the terms and conditions at the end of the proposal where you would sign, and essentially that was a contract. And what I found was, if I was working for a smaller contractor, that was fine, they would sign it. But a bigger contractor, it just wouldn't get, it would be superseded by the JCT or whatever, which was a shame. But again, from my background, which is kind of marketing and is kind of copywriting, I always have this view that people use more words, not all the time, but a lot of the time, they incorporate ambiguity. They use more words because actually, sometimes they want to just hide the beef, basically, of what they're trying to say. And sometimes, you know, if I'm the cynical me says, well, these main contractors, they want to add as much ambiguity in there as possible, because if it gets to a dispute, they're giving themselves loads of tunnels and places they can take this.
It's certainly ambiguity and uncertainty and hiding nasty conditions is certainly one of the reasons why people write long contracts. But some of it is because they just don't know how to make it shorter, because they've copied and pasted off the internet. And if you copy and paste off the internet, things just get naturally longer rather than shorter. So hiding ambiguity is one reason, but a lot of it is just not really understanding what ought to be in a contract and then just copying complete rubbish and making themselves feel better. Some of it is about status and bullying the other side into saying, look, this is how big my contract is, you know, just sign it because I've got a right, I've got a whopper, you know.
Okay,
you know.
And someone I did deal with used those words exactly.
It's not an attractive way to build a business, really.
Definitely not. But that's where we're at, because But then that, it just brings you back to the JCT, doesn't it? Which is 50,000 words. And that's our industry standard for the majority of private projects, right? So that's where we are. That's our baseline. And it's interesting that you're trying to engineer us to a middle ground or somewhere near that. And look, let's talk about more of this after this break.
Own to Build is brought to you from our sponsor, Sealink, software used by developers and main contractors to manage subcontract procurement in one place. Find subcontractors, automate tenders and contracts, control construction program, compare prices, and improve project profitability with Sealink. To find out more, head to c-link.com. Now back to the show.
Sarah, at Sealink, we have got software which automates contracts, among other things. Now, we've got a few different contract types. Some of them are based on the JCT, and they're extensive, and typically are used for £200,000-£250,000 plus packages. Then we have a separate small works order, which I'm inclined to stop calling a small works order, because I don't think it necessarily is, but it generally is for that 200 to 250k and below. That contract, which is really, really popular actually with our users, they all like it, is 3,000 words. So it's relatively short. I actually went and checked it today and thought, oh God, we're six times as much as Sarah. She's going to slate me. But I'm going to put it out there because we're in the right, we're on that journey with you. The trouble I have is that people, when they're buying £300,000-£400,000 worth of M&E, let's say, they just say to me, for that one, I've got to use the JCT style contract for more protection. How does that make you feel?
It's the teddy bear approach to contracting. which is that they use JCT because it's comfortable. They've had it for years. They've had it probably since they were a small child. You know, JCT's been around since 1963. But the standard contract that JCT launched in 1963 was only 25 pages long. So, you know, their contract is growing massively all the time. But people feel comfortable with it. But actually, most people, if you say, how does it protect you more than this 3,000-word contract, haven't got a clue. They don't even know what the major causes of dispute are. They don't know what the most important terms are for either the contractor or the consultant or the subcontractor. They don't know any of that stuff. They don't follow the data. They don't take a logical approach to choosing a contract, amending a contract, using a contract. They take basically a historical teddy bear approach. It's kind of more emotional than anything else.
I haven't heard the teddy bear approach before, but it makes perfect sense. It's like a warm and cuddly feeling inside. But that warm and cuddly feeling, which I haven't really thought about before, seems to stem from just a complete lack of education and a complete ignorance to actually, why, like you say, why do I want that teddy bear? Explain it, and you'd go, I don't really know, but it's just got loads of stuff in it, which is probably better for me, right?
Because somebody says I should have a teddy bear. You know,
yeah, it's fundamentally problematic, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you ask people, why do you use a specific form of contract? They say, well, I've always used it. It's been okay so far. And then when they change, you say, why did you change contracts? They said, well, we had a bit of a problem. So we blamed it on the contract. And we changed a new one. It's like, right, rather than solve your contract, you've just gone and, you know, grabbed another vehicle. And then when that goes wrong, you're going to go back again. It's like, that's no way to logically run your business, and contracts run your business. You know, we're now letting the tail wag the dog rather than the other way around by kind of going, well, I like that sort of dog today and that sort of dog tomorrow because that one bit me. You know, I know we've moved from teddy bears to dogs to vehicles and all that kind of stuff, but trying to find an analogy that works is, if you say to people, why do you use this contract? They kind of go, I know what it says. And then when you say to them, well, what does it say? They haven't got a clue.
It's funny though, isn't it?
Because they don't want to look stupid, because everyone's supposed to know what JCT is.
Yeah.
Where most people don't actually know what JCT is.
No. And we know what the language is, because the language from JCT is spread all the way through construction. So if we talk about extensions of time, loss and extents, practical completion, liquidated and ascertained damages, these are all terminology that JCT invented. You know, that only comes from JCT, and then they use it with other contracts, so it doesn't even make sense in the context of other contracts, because it's not recorded in those other contracts.
Yeah.
There's an example. What? I was going to say, when I came into subcontracting, like I say, and I come from a different industry, and something absolutely blew me away, and I think it's just unique to construction, because I thought, so I was on this job, and a quantity surveyor, I'm new to construction, right? We need to order some more materials that weren't, it's a variation, right? They weren't in their order. And I gave him a price, right? And he said, that seems a bit steep. Can you show me the invoice of where you're getting them? I said, no. I'm sorry. I just want to know your profit margin. And I said, what? I'm not showing you that. And obviously later I realised, okay, that is a thing that happens in the construction industry, and some contracts are cost plus and all this. But he didn't understand, because that is so abnormal for any other, no other business or industry would, before I'd say, yeah, I'd like to know exactly how much money you're making on me. It was just in this bubble construction.
Yeah, it's bonkers. But then you also get people who don't want to show their margins, so they fake invoices so they can hide what their margins are. And that, all of that doesn't drive transparent, flexible, cooperative behaviours, all the sort of things that the construction playbook is talking about. You know, we've ended up with a massively dysfunctional way of contracting, both on paper and in practice.
But so the trouble is, with these topics, I really struggle to see the wood through the trees, to be honest with you. Because, so how do we resolve this? How do we turn the needle from 500 to 50,000 to bring it down to 10,000, 5,000? Because it's clearly an educational issue as much as anything. But how can we change it? That's what I'm struggling to.
Well, Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And I think one of the things that's quite interesting is how automation is changing. But actually, when I see quite a lot of automation projects or even smart contracts in construction, they're taking the existing standard forms and trying to digitise those. Well, they are not suitable for digitisation because they're not based on zeros and ones. Computers don't work on reasonables and maybes and, you know, forthwiths and all this kind of stuff. They need a clear yes, no answer. So the first thing we need to do is think about how we can make processes work with flowcharts, how we can make things simpler. So actually we get rid of the fluff, because what's the point of automating a load of digital fluff? I mean, it'll just create digital dust, you know. We need to create contracts. And I think the thing that's really interesting is in quite a lot of other global sectors, we have talk about the deal velocity. So how quickly we can get into deals. And I think when construction starts to kind of take into account the amount of upfront time they have dealing with the contracts, and they think about, actually, could I get into a contract tomorrow if I made it much simpler? Would it change the behaviours? Because if actually we've got all the information in the works documents, the programme, or if we've got all of that, we've got the pricing details, as much as we do or don't want to share that, why are we waiting so much and wasting so much time, effort and energy on the sort of legal stuff around the edges?
But is that not what, if I was being devil's advocate and I was the man or woman who wrote the JCT, I would say, well, that's what the JCT does. You can get into contract on a standard form JCT in 24 hours. It's the industry standard. Put all your pricing documents or whatever else with it. That's fine.
Yeah, You could do. When I first started writing a 500-word contract, though, the chair of JCT at the time says we can't have single-page contracts because there's not enough trust in the industry. Well, that's a chicken and egg answer, isn't it? Which comes first, trust or a simple contract? Because you can't say we've got a comprehensive adversarial-based contract that drives trust, because it doesn't. JCT does not drive trust. There are lots of good things about having standard contracts, like making it quicker to do deals and knowing what you're bidding on and, you know, incorporating the risk profile in your tender price. Brilliant. But why don't we make that contract a really good contract rather than a really comprehensive rubbish contract that's a bit woolly around the edges?
I 100% agree with that. If you give someone a 500-word contract, that creates trust because you're not trying to hide anything. Give someone a 50,000-word contract, I'm not going to trust you. Simple.
And the reality is most people who use the 50,000 words, even unamended, don't understand what it says.
Yeah, well, that's I'm not professing to know everything in the JCT, far from it, but there was a point in my career where I thought, God, no one in my office, I was working for a big company, I thought, no one in my office has a clue what is in this document. I'm going to try and work out what's in it. But as you say, it meant that probably 5 or 6 clauses or pages of the 50,000 words I had a good grasp on, but everyone thought I was this fountain of knowledge on the document. But if you'd actually asked me about it, I barely had a clue. But that's probably, that's just so, that's why I'm, again, struggling to see how you solve it, because it's such a...
You can't solve it by using the thinking we've had so far, which is let's just tinker at the edges with JCT. Because every 5 years they tinker at it and they tinker at it and they tinker at it. If you said to people now, okay, right, we're in a new normal. All the contracts that have ever existed have, you know, there's been a massive bonfire. We've lost them. They haven't, you know, survived the apocalypse. They never existed. You wouldn't say to people, right, okay, let's try and record this deal in a way that helps build trust, that avoids dispute, that focuses on what's important to the parties. You're not going to sit down and write 100 pages like that and go, yeah, that's a really good idea. You're going to go, I'll tell you what's the minimum we can get away with? You know, because really, it's about the commercial relationships. Most big companies, you know, even the Carillions, you know, the companies that have gone bust, most of them didn't actually focus on the terms of their contract when they had disputes. They had good relationships or bad relationships. Yeah, you know what, they're going to sue occasionally, but less than 0.007% are going to go near court proceedings.
They were exactly the organisation I was thinking about when I was referring to the 50-page 50,000 JCT, 50,000 amendments, and them saying, well, it won't matter, will it? Because, and it ended up
being... Met contractors are some of the worst offenders for writing extremely one-sided contracts. The worst ones I've ever seen are main contractors and subcontractor. And that's really interesting because they make their subcontractors sign contracts that they wouldn't dream of signing. that it's a really dysfunctional approach to say. It's like the parents screaming at their child to stop shouting. You know, it's like, whoa, hang on. I don't think you're showing best practice here.
But it's got to come top down then, hasn't it? But
I don't know, does it? Because I used to think top down, but top down is you're talking about banks. Banks are deeply risk averse, and the economic crisis, the pandemic and everything else hasn't helped. Insurance companies, deeply risk averse, massively under problems because of the pandemic. If we started with something which, you know, two people in a van, or, you know, small specialist subcontractors now heading into the sort of £1 million contracts could do on their phone, and they could start bringing it up the supply chain. Actually, why wouldn't that benefit everyone? Because what people said to me when I first did it was, people couldn't write their own contracts. It's like, what do you think the 350,000 SMEs and micro enterprises in construction in the UK do now? They don't pay someone to do it. They don't buy a JCT. They just copy and paste some random stuff off the internet. At least if they copied and pasted my stuff, at least it'd be decent. It would cover the most important stuff and it would be in words that they understood.
Is that then who, going back to kind of Liam's question, so is that the market that you're trying to reach? You're trying to get these SMEs to use, rather than emails or chopping and changing things, are you trying to educate them like, this is a really good template and a basis for you to then build a contract?
Yeah, do you know what? Anyone who looks at it and thinks, actually, that's really different, it doesn't matter. I've worked with trade associations, so I've worked with the Federation of Master Builders, I've worked with property investors, I've worked with small companies, you know, all sorts of people who are interested in just simplifying what they've currently got. Specialist subcontractors, you kind of start with a real skill set and then end up creeping up the value chain and getting bigger and bigger contracts and realise they've just not got anything that works. And they're facing the huge contracts that are being sent to them by main contractors, and just they don't know whether they're coming or going most of the time. You know, for me, the only thing that's important is it's simple. They can read it, they can understand, they can use it. Absolute length is not the issue. 500 words is, it's not a gimmick,
it's the
but it's kind of like, yeah. It's a concept that you can, in fact, have a contract on a few pieces of paper that you can
maybe read, 3,000 words. Use.
You know, 3,000 is okay. As long
brilliant.
As they're 3,000 good words, they have to be simple and clear and effective.
Yeah. I think it very much depends as a small contractor who you're working for, because I think in my experience, as you say, as you creep up the chain, if you're working for main contractors, you will pretty quickly get to a scenario where they won't even entertain signing anything that you give them anyway, and unless you're prepared to walk away, you're probably, if you want that order, you're probably going to have to sign their 50,000 word contract. And so it would have to be, and it's not in their interest to reduce it. I don't. Well,
you're right, but everyone said that, you know, telly would kill radio, and they both subsist together in the same space. And actually, you know, Spotify and all these kind of new tech ideas have actually changed our way of doing work, and we're going, actually, yeah, there are some people who still like their vinyl records, and that's great, and you know, they're niche, and that, you know, that's their thing. But actually, there's no reason why we can't change by chipping away at the objections to using simpler contracts, and actually by just turning around and saying, you know what, these contracts cost a lot of money, they take a lot of time. If you invested that time that you currently invest in doing the contract deal the traditional way and put it into running the relationship, you would actually start with a simple contract, invest more in your relationships, same result. What's a loss? The only difference is you're not paying lawyers, standard form publishers and everyone else thousands of pounds to try and resolve the issues before you start. It doesn't work. You know, the big cases that went to court over the last few years have all been on amended standard forms. That hasn't changed the position between the parties.
It doesn't, but I think, again, I can only speak from my experience, I would love it all to be 500 words, by the way. But I think that in a lot of cases, not all main contractors, there are some good ones, but whilst very few cases go to court, what often can happen is there's a dispute over an application and it doesn't go to court, but they're just going to withhold the payment because we're not in agreement until, and as a smaller contractor, what
you're right, but the contract has nothing to do with that, any of that behaviour.
No, it doesn't. But the smaller contractor doesn't know that, and what you've got as a smaller subcontractor is, as you say, you probably don't have a quantity surveyor, never mind a lawyer, and they do have more than you, and it's intimidating, and you need the cash, and so what you really need to do is to push back at the start and say, I'm not signing that.
Yeah, and it's difficult to do, but you know, I think as more and more people say, we're not, you know, the power of we know the power of consumers, we know the power of loads and loads of individuals saying we don't want this anymore. You know, we've seen it time and time again that you can create change from the ground up, because sometimes the big companies, you know, climate change, the fact that COP26 is happening, the climate change is a classic example of where individual actions force big change in corporates, because the corporates don't want to do it. They're not interested in changing the status quo. They've got very rich with the status quo. Like the main contractors have got not very rich, but moderately profitable with the status quo. So why would they change anything? They don't see the driver for change. But actually, there's no reason why everybody else can't keep nudging them. And eventually, a few nudges will actually make a big difference.
Maybe it's the associations of the subspecialist contractors, because again, I use roofing because that's what I was in, but if, you know, if the roofing association, NFRC, if their members got together and said, you know, we're not going to do those contracts anymore, we're doing these, we're doing it like this way, well, then there is power there, because you're going to need one of those members.
Yeah, you're completely right. But a lot of the trade associations have their relationships with lawyers, and the lawyers, you know, still got their traditional ways of drafting. So I don't think this is going to be solved in my lifetime. But I do think that it will change radically, particularly as we automate more, we create more smart contracts, all that kind of stuff. We're going to need to fundamentally change the way we create, negotiate, sign and keep our contracts. And actually being able to keep them on your phone, wouldn't that be brilliant? Let me show you something.
Here we go.
So this is a facsimile of a 5,000-year-old contract, okay?
Yeah.
So this is in the British, the original's in the British Museum. This is a contract for construction services. And this is small enough to hold in the palm of your hand. And it was designed to be read by people not with the same language as their masters. So this was actually slave labour on construction projects. So it was all done in pictures. This is great technology. We don't have contracts that are across languages, across knowledge, across intellect, and that you can hold in the palm of your hand. Why not? Because that would be the most powerful contract that we could have on a construction project, one that everyone understood, that would sit in your pocket and that you could look at and go, oh yeah, I'm due 4 gallons of beer today because I've done 6 hours of work.
Ooh, it's starting to sound good. It's starting to sound very good, this construction
contract. It was paid in a mix of porridge and beer.
Yeah, really? That was a problem I always had. They spend all their money on the beer and they're not feeling well on Monday and don't come in.
No, it's your passion for this, Sarah, is incredible. If you were to give, you know, this is obviously a process that we maybe need to go through as an industry. If you were to give our listeners one bit of advice as to how they could start to change their mentality towards contracts, what would that advice be?
I'm going to give them the unpalatable advice that they should read a contract from start to finish, because only then, when they realise they haven't got a Scooby-Doo what any of that stuff means, will they realise how useless that piece of paper is.
You want them to go and read the JCT? You are mean.
No. Start with something small. Start with something small. Start with, you know, the terms and conditions of an online platform they use, or, you know, start small, but start to read them, because it's only when we read them that we realise how much they're stitching us up, how much they're hiding the nasties, how much they're not helping us do business, and think, you know what, if this isn't helping my business, what am I doing using it at all? It's like you wouldn't go to a toolbox and pick out a screwdriver if you wanted, and then start hammering with it because it's the wrong tool for the job. Same with these contracts. They are the wrong tool for the job.
I think Paul would genuinely
pick up a screwdriver.
Well, no, I've done that, to be fair, when I've just been lazy.
Yeah, but you might do it once, but you don't do it repeatedly.
No, but I bet Paul would genuinely rather read the JCT than Harry Potter.
You're close there, girls. You are close. You're not far wrong. And on that beautiful note, I will say, I think that has been an incredibly interesting episode, Sarah. You've brought a lot of passion to that topic, and it's definitely opened my eyes a little bit as to how different we could be. So I'll be putting details of Sarah's details and Sarah's company's details in the podcast description. Reach out to her. Things are going to change. Forget the JCT, and life can be very, very different. Thank you very much for coming in, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Sarah.
Absolute pleasure. Curls, I'll see you next week, mate. And Sarah, I'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.